Well, this morning the world is coming to grips with a potential calamity. As one commentator on Late Line said last night, the worst possible spectre that haunts the Middle East is threatening to revisit the region right now. A Sunni-Shia war, stretching more or less right across the area. Tensions have clearly been brewing in Iraq between the two religious and cultural groups, the Sunnis and the Shia, but by and large, outside observers had tended to position these as small-scale skirmishes and resentments. However, with the stunning successes this week of the Sunni Islamist group, the ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, and the failings of the Iraqi military, anxiety is reaching sky-high levels about what this might portend, especially after hearing the most senior Shiite cleric in Iraq, Ayatollah al-Sistani, openly call yesterday for all men to take up arms to defend themselves against the insurgents. Now, this is incredibly serious, because it brings to the surface the existential fears held by each side about the other, and the risks that this could spread and bring Syrian-type hostilities into Iraq. Turkey is also caught up in this, with around 50 of its diplomats and other citizens being held hostage. Plus, there's a rise of a new jihadist chief, said to be Osama bin Laden's real successor, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who's the head of ISIS. So again, what are we to make of all this? Kamran Bokhari is the Vice President of Middle Eastern and South Asian Affairs at Stratfor. It's a geopolitical intelligence firm based in Austin, Texas. He's also author of the book Political Islam in the Age of Democratization. And he joins me from Toronto in Canada. Welcome to Saturday Extra, Kamran.
Thanks for having me.
How seriously do you rate these developments?
I think that it is pretty serious, but there is a context. I mean, ISIS used to be ISI, which was the acronym for Islamic State of Iraq, before it went into Syria after the Arab Spring and was able to capture a large amount of territory in the Levantine country. And now it has returned back to its birthplace. And what we are seeing now is that for the first time, it appears that the Shiite camp led by Iran is on the defensive against what is not an ISIS, if you will, project. ISIS is probably at the center of all of this, but ISIS is not alone. ISIS has the support of a large segment of the Iraqi Sunni community that it has grown very bitter about being dominated by a pro-Iranian Shiite government led by Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. And therefore, for the first time since the overthrow of Saddam, the Sunnis appear ascendant. Now, is this a sustainable trend? We just don't know it yet, because we don't know what kind of capability does ISIS and its Iraqi allies have. Are they going to be able to just simply maintain their grip in the Sunni areas and prevent the state from reestablishing as writ? Or are they going to be able to project power into the north towards the Kurdish areas and southwards towards Baghdad and the Shiite south?
Well, that's precisely, I suppose, it's the possibility that they might, which is prompting people like al-Sistani, who doesn't say things like that normally, I don't think, to speak out and call for this sort of mobilisation. The fact that the sense that the very lack of certainty around this is the worry.
Absolutely, and you're right. Ayatollah Sistani never engages in sort of any rhetoric, any political statement that's inflammatory. He's known for being from what is called the quietest school of the Shiite clergy, and refraining from direct, involvement in politics, and certainly against clerical involvement in politics, and leaving the politics to the politicians. And he's always been a voice of intersectarian harmony. And now we have him making this fatwa, which is essentially a call to arms. And he's not alone. If you notice, the much celebrated moderate president of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, gave a very strong statement yesterday saying that Iran will not tolerate what's going on in Iraq, and we will fight this. I mean, those were very, very powerful words from someone who is otherwise seen as a pragmatist, as a moderate, as someone who wants to put Iran's sort of radical past behind the country and, you know, move towards more integration with the international community. So we are definitely, these are signs that the Shia of Iraq and Iran are extremely worried about what has happened.
Yes, exactly. And it has been pointed out that this area of Mosul and Tikrit and the whole Anbar province is exactly where the Sunni insurgency was during, I think, 2004 to 2006, which then, of course, General Petraeus came in and pushed that back. And you know, these are all memories of our recent past. So are you really hinting that you think it is containable, that it's understandable, and that are you saying that the Shia forces will prevail? Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying here is that we don't know the order of battle of the Sunni forces. What began as, well, 1,500 men came in and overtook Mosul, and if you think about it, Mosul is a city of over 2 million people. So even if you factor in hundreds of thousands of refugees fleeing to the north, you are still talking a very large-sized city. How can 1,300 or 2,000 or a few thousand men take over the city? And they're not just that, then project power into Saddam's hometown of Tikrit, go after the refinery in Baiji, and maintain their presence in Anbar province. So this is not the work of a few thousand men. Of course, ISIS is probably composed of several thousand men, but beyond ISIS, this is a general uprising on the part of the Sunnis. The ISIS could not have done this without internal support. So I come back to the issue of, so what is the firepower capability of this force? Is it sufficient to keep the government out of the Sunni areas and hunker down, or is it capable of further power projection? I think it is the former. I think that what we're going to see is that the Shiite forces, in collaboration with the Kurdish Peshmergas and with Turkish and Iranian and American support, will be able to contain the Sunni uprising, but it's going to be very difficult for the central government to go back into the Sunni areas and reestablish its writ. And this is where I am right now, but the days ahead will tell us, you know, whether or not, you know, I'm right in my prediction.
Yes, well, of course, it was the spectre of the Iraqi army sort of evaporating, melting in Mosul that was such a shock. And we actually have a clip from our former chief of army who served in Iraq, General Peter Lay, on what he saw at stake.
This is, I think, a failure of the Iraqi army, and we have to think very carefully what that means. I think what we're seeing is a failure of, and I'll talk in military terms here, the morale element of combat power. I think we prepared that force quite well. We got them to a stage with the organisation and the equipment and their training, but what we've seen is there's no fight in them. And that's not something that you can imbue in people. That has to become a part of their morale, their sense of allegiance and loyalty to the country. That's the failure. I don't think we can be blamed for that. That's what the government of Iraq has to do, make these people loyal. And clearly, they're not loyal.
Well, do you agree with General Peter Lay, Kamran, that, and you know, again, this will very much determine the course of the next few months, will it not?
Indeed. I largely agree with the general, but I would add that there is an issue of quality of the armed forces, not just in training, but morale. And we must factor in the aspect that these forces not only were stationed in essentially hostile terrain. I mean, imagine a Shiite-dominated military force sitting inside and trying to police a Sunni-majority area where, you know, sectarian resentment is at an all-time high. And then these are not just Shiites. They were Sunnis who were part of the armed forces stationed in Mosul and in the surrounding areas. And it is quite likely that many of those may have defected to the other side. And the remaining forces, did not have the morale to stay there. And they said it is, you know, probably better to flee and with your lives, as opposed to be, you know, in front of a very angry mob, essentially, that is armed. And so I think that there are quite a number of factors that we have to look at when we talk about the Iraqi army. And again, I go back to the point, the distinction between reimposing the writ in the Sunni areas and protecting the rest of the country. I think that protecting the rest of the country will be easy, especially because the Iranian military advisors and the mobilization of Shiite militias and help from the Kurds and U.S. air support and Turkish assets will help them, you know, protect the rest of the country, will likely protect the rest of the country, but it's going to be another thing to go back into the Sunni areas. That's the key thing.
Fair enough, which suggests balkanization of Iraq, but also you haven't mentioned Saudi Arabia. I mean, how are the big Sunni powers likely to look on at this?
Well, I think that even though that Saudi Arabia, not too long ago, I would say about 2.5 months ago, declared ISIS as a terrorist entity and has been mobilizing anti-ISIS and anti-Al-Qaeda Salafi jihadi militias in Syria. Having said that, I'd say that what Saudi Arabia is likely smiling at this point, because it has gone from a situation where its efforts to topple the pro-Iranian regime of Bashar al-Assad literally has failed, and Iran has struck back, and the Iranian and Hezbollah and the Assad regime have regained ground. Now, after that debacle, if you see the Shiites and the Iranians on the defensive in their core turf, which is Iraq, I think that the Saudis and the Sunni powers are pleased with what they see.
Okay.
But then again, this could also blow up in their face, because ultimately, at the end of the day, ISIS is not their friend, and if they decide to, or if they're found to have supported the entire initiative, that could lead to a worsening of relations with the United States and Turkey, and could push the Iranians and the Americans even closer than the Saudis have wanted.
Look, just with a minute to go, what about this man? So some people are saying he's the real successor to Osama bin Laden, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Now, I know you're a specialist on jihadists. Put him in context for us, please.
Yes, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is not his real name. We actually don't really know for sure what his real name is, because that nom de guerre has been used by a number of his predecessors as well.
Just make it fast, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, and so, but definitely, he now basically presides over the largest jihadist entity in the planet. Why? Because they own large tracts of land in Syria, including oil fields.
Okay.
And they have now demonstrated a significant firepower capability in Iraq.
Thank you. Kamran, I've just got the news coming up on me, and I'm very sorry. I'd love to go on. We'll have to
have
you back. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Kamran Bakari, Vice President of Middle East and Southeast Asian Affairs at Stratfor. We'll be back after 8 with a lot more.